This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Okay, Carl, I think it's time we should start. So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Chris Burrell. I'd like to welcome you to this special session this afternoon discussing the origins of life, the evolution of life. These are questions that civilizations have grappled with and have pondered. Where have we come from? How did it all start? How did we reach this point? And each of civilization has developed its own account, its own answers to this. The ancient Greeks had answers. The Nordic civilizations had answers. The dream time of the Aborigines. And, of course, the main religions of the Middle East all had their answers to this. But in the past three decades, we've seen an extraordinary expansion of scientific capacity to examine this in astronomy, organic chemistry, in the biological sciences. And there's been great progress to peel away more of the layers of the onion in the quest for trying to understand this intriguing and scary sort of question. Well, I said this is a special session. The last few days, we've been hearing Antonio Lascano in many of the sessions. He tells me now that he's increasingly recognised when he walks the streets of Adelaide. Everyone has recognised him. We've appreciated his scientific breadth, his wisdom, his humour. But this afternoon, we're to hear him lecture on his personal area, where he's an absolute international leader. He's a professor at the National Independent University of Mexico. He's the president of the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. He's also a researcher into the chemical basis for the origins of life. He's an educator, a scientific journalist and a teacher, a writer of textbooks for schools and the public, for the general public. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're privileged to hear Antonio Lascano on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris, for the presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I have to say that for me it's an absolute privilege to be back in Australia, to be here in this hall, and to have the chance to share with you some of my ideas on the origins of life, which I decided was good to put in the context of evolutionary theory, because this being a festival of ideas, one should underline that the idea of evolution is one of the greatest intellectual achievements of Western civilization, and from there it spread worldwide in a way that it's absolutely amazing. One thing that has to be said right ahead is that whenever we think about evolution, the great name that comes into mind is that of Charles Darwin. But one should be very much reminded that, in fact, the idea of evolution is older than Charles Darwin, is older than the origin of the species. In fact, there is a lengthy chronology of the idea of change in nature that started not among biologists, but in fact started among astronomers, when Kant in 1786 proposed the idea that the solar system itself was the outcome of the collapse of a nebula of interstellar gas that somehow gave rise to the sun and the Earth. And later on, this idea was actually put in mathematical terms by the Marquis de Laplace, who made that very famous remark when Napoleon told him, "I don't see the word God mentioned in your book." And the answer was, "Sir, this is a hypothesis. I do not need to explain the origin of the solar system." But the idea of evolution was already in science. And then, of course, we know of Darwin and his publication in 1859 of The Origin of Species. But it was preceded, in fact, 50 years by the work of Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck, who proposed a book called La Philosophie Zoologique, in which also the idea of evolution, transformation of a species was proposed. Lyell, who was a professor of Darwin, spoke about the evolution of the of the surface of the Earth. Sadiq Carnot and Thompson spoke about how you can have a system that is isolated in thermodynamically, not able to exchange matter and energy with the surroundings, and that goes to increase entropy, to increase disorder. So here we have the idea of time in thermodynamics, the idea of evolutionary thermodynamics. Spencer was writing of language evolution, and Malthus, which some of my more leftist friends don't like to very much, was actually speaking about evolution of human populations. Renan in France was speaking about the evolution of religions. Marx and Engels spoke about socio-economical evolution, the evolution of productive systems. So what we really see is that the 19th century is the time in which the idea of change, of evolution, of modifications in time becomes deeply ingrained in Western culture. In this sense, Charles Darwin should be seen not as the starter of the idea of evolution, but rather as the culmination of 19th century thoughts on evolution. Now, by one of those extraordinary things that happened in history, as I already mentioned, Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck published in 1809 his book of La Philosophie Zoologique, and in a way this book became the birth certificate of Charles Darwin, who was born precisely on 1809, and who was himself as, in fact, a follower of Lamarck. Now, whenever we think about Darwin, we think about this very venerable English gentleman, a member of the rural gentry that came from a very distinguished family and changed forever the way we look at life, the way we look at ourselves. But the fact is that we shouldn't forget that Darwin once was a very young fellow. And when he was a young fellow, he didn't happen to be a very distinguished student. So much, in fact, that his family, his father especially, had very deep concerns about the family reputation because of his very poor achievements in school. Now, Darwin came from a family that on the father's side had very, very distinguished physicians, especially his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was a larger-than-life figure. He developed a number of very interesting ideas on therapeutics, on the use of electrical discharges to cure a number of ailments, so much to the point that if you read the dedication of Frankenstein by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, you will find out that it is dedicated precisely to Dr. Darwin, whose researchers have demonstrated the truth of what is described in this book. He made a tremendous impact in English society. His son, Robert Darwin, who was a very stern gentleman, as all Englishmen, he was very fond of gardening, of course, but he was very stern with his children. And he finally decided that both Charles Darwin and Erasmus, his brother, should be sent to the best possible medical school in the United Kingdom. So they were sent to the Edinburgh School of Medicine, where one of the things that was... for me, it's very natural, not for my American colleagues, is that you didn't have to be ordained to be a teacher in that university. Charles Darwin went there with his brother. He was there only for 6 months or so, and we know exactly why he left medical school. First of all, he could not tolerate the idea of blood. The idea of smelling blood, of looking blood, made him absolutely ill. Secondly, he could not cope with the weather in Edinburgh. Lovely people, but horrible weather. And thirdly, he said, I cannot accept the idea of getting up at 5 in the morning, have a Scottish breakfast, and then go to lectures. So he left school, and the family decided, well, if you're not good as a physician, you might as well be good as a minister. So he was sent to Cambridge to study divinity. He was not exactly what you would call an outstanding scientist. And then, thanks to family connection and family money, he got a position as a naturalist in the Beagle under the leadership of Captain Fitzroy. Now, we know exactly what Darwin's feelings were when he boarded the Beagle, because he wrote on the very first day in his diary, "This place is crowded, it's very smelly, it moves a lot, it's very noisy. I cannot see how I can tolerate being in this boat for 5 years." And the boat was still tied up to the piers of Plymouth. he had all the elements to be a failure, but then, with his extraordinary powers of observation, with an extraordinary boiling brain in which everything was being sucked and connected and so on, he finally came back to England, went back to England, decided that London was not the place for him to be, moved into Down. He married his cousin, which is something that always is prone to jokes in Mexico, I have to say. He married his cousin and settled there and became, in many ways, the reluctant revolutionary. Darwin, for me, is the best example of how we should not ever have a prejudice about the men and women that can change life, that can change society. He was the less outstanding revolutionary, and nevertheless, he changed forever the way we see ourselves and the way we see life on Earth. And of course, all of you know that after much pressure from his friends, after receiving the letter from Wallace, who came out with a similar idea on natural selection, he published in 1859 the famous Origin of a Species. And as one of his peers remarked, you might have as well published a book on pigeons, because the book is full of examples taken from how you can raise pigeons or horses or sheep or cows and select features that you find interesting for different purposes. The basic idea, however, behind the Origin of a Species is a very simple one. It's the fact that you can understand the unity and diversity of life thanks to a common origin and to the mechanism of natural selection. It's a very simple but a very powerful idea. So simple, so powerful that Huxley, one of his best friends, once said, "It's a pity that idea didn't occur to me." I think it's the best praise one can have for a colleague, for a friend. Such a simple idea, and it was brewing in his mind for a number of years. Now, if you read The Origin of a Species, you will find that at some parts it's very dense, it's full of detail, it can be a little bit complicated to enjoy, but one part of his writings that I enjoy enormously is reading his notebooks. And I like them because there you can see the way his mind was actually working. This particular page I'm very fond of for a very simple reason. It says, "I think." And this "I think" summarizes in a very simple phrase the doubts, the certainties, the questioning that he was undergoing. And then he draws this hypothetical phylogenetic tree in which he explains how you could have divergence of different species from a common ancestor. And then there is this other page from one of his notebooks that I'm particularly fond of, thinking of the origins of life, because here you have three hypothetical species drawn in bold lines, and just looking at the similarities, Darwin proposes, okay, so these two must have diverged later on from the ancestor of this other species. And he has in broken line a hypothetical phylogeny. And I like the idea of a broken line as a hypothesis of evolutionary relationship, because that's exactly what our phylogenies are. Whenever we construct a phylogenetic tree, what we are proposing is a hypothesis of evolutionary relationship that may be correct or may be wrong. And we have to be, in biology, extremely eclectic in the sense that we take all possible data on behavior, on molecules, on biogeographical distribution, on morphology, in order to complete, to assert or not our hypothesis. Now, the other thing that you can see from these two pages is that, from Darwin's notebooks, is that although he failed medical studies, he did keep physicians' handwritings until the very end of his life. It's quite an ordeal to go through his notebooks and try to understand them, to the point that there are some words and phrases that have always been left with a question mark because we really don't know what he wanted to mean. Nevertheless, I want you to please compare these phylogenetic tree with the one that is drawn on the basis of the comparison of a molecule that is involved in the replication of retroviruses, specifically the HIV virus. We can construct, using exactly the same basic principles that Darwin developed, we can come out with a history of the HIV virus, which is, of course, a major pathogen, which has caused a tremendous change. It has tremendous socio-economical consequences, has led to the isolation of people in a terrible way, and so on. And here what you have is how we can actually reconstruct the different the relationships of different strains of the HIV the virus, we can actually put the place of what is probably one of the oldest HIV virus that we can recognize from a sample, blood sample that was kept by chance in Belgium from 1959 until today. We can relate the HIV virus to other retroviruses. We can deduce without any problem that, in fact, the two epidemics that we are witnessing comes from two different jumps that retroviruses made from different primates into our own species. And this is showing, in fact, how using the methodology developed by Darwin first, that retroviruses evolve, diversify, and can overcome the species barrier. It's very complicated to get a visa to visit Australia. Viruses don't need a visa to jump from one species into the other. Viruses are the perfect way to actually go through frontiers undetected in many ways through the taxonomical frontiers that separate different living entities. And this particular tree shows very clearly that evolutionary theory is not something that is related only to the disappearance of dinosaurs or to the emergence of land plants. Evolution is something that has to do with our everyday life, because it's true that we can reconstruct the evolution of a retrovirus like the HIV-1, but it's also true that using evolutionary criteria, we can actually develop therapies to control the development of the disease in people that are infected. So quite clearly, evolution is not something only for textbooks. It has to do with our everyday life. And there's another wonderful example of this, which has to do with bacterial resistance to antibiotics. I made the experiment today in a pharmacy, in a chemist office nearby. I went and asked him, can I have an antibiotic because I have some diarrhea? I have no diarrhea, I have to say. But I wanted to test how it works in Australia. And the question immediately came from the chemist, can I see your prescription? And I say, I have none. And he said, well, I'm sorry, then I cannot give you any antibiotic. If you do the same experiment in Latin America or in a number of Asiatic countries, you will immediately get the antibiotic you need without any prescription. In other words, there are a number of societies in which the people can administer themselves an antibiotic, which is normally used in a very unprofessional way, without any medical control, not for the time that's necessary to actually complete the scheme, and the result is that we are developing resistance to antibiotics. How does that happen? Well, assume that we have a bacteria that begins reproducing, and all of a sudden you have a mutant, just by chance or because it acquires a virus that carries on the gene that can decompose a given antibiotic, and it will not prevail among the population of other bacteria, among other things, because it has no advantage. But the moment we apply to this colony of bacteria, whether in our guts or whether in under laboratory conditions, then what immediately happens is that the bacterial strains that are resistant to an antibiotic will be selected. It's a very simple mechanism, and the basic point to underline here is that natural selection has no foresight, no goals, it only produces result. That is the basic idea behind natural selection. And of course, in this case, we can reconstruct the genealogy of these different strains of bacteria, but in biology, in historical times, in a historical perspective, genealogy means phylogeny, and that means reconstructing the history of life on Earth. And we actually can do so very easily, and by comparing, for instance, the molecules involved in the synthesis of proteins, we have come up to recognize that at a cellular level, life on Earth is not divided in plants or animals, is not divided in prokaryotes or eukaryotes only, but it's actually divided into three major groups that are called the bacteria, like the ones that produce the yogurt that you had for breakfast, the archaea, which are basically fastidious prokaryotes that like to live, most of them, under extreme conditions, and eukaryotes, which is, of course, the branch of the tree in which ourselves and most our relatives and best friends are located. I have to say that I have said here that these are major groups. There is a word that is used by a very distinguished microbiologist Carl Woese, which is domains. The domain archaea, the domain bacteria, and the domain eukarya. But as a Latin American, I always feel a little bit uneasy when Americans use the word domains. So let me just refer to them as lineages, three basic lineages. One of the things that has emerged very quickly from this overall picture of the biosphere is that most of the diversity that we see of life on Earth is dominated by microbes. Unseen microbes have been the dominant form of life on Earth since it started more than 3.8, 10 to the 9 years ago until today. Prokaryotes, bacteria, and archaea, and many eukaryotic microbes are in fact where we find the greatest diversity on life. And without them, we would not be here. You can take away the fungi, you can take away humans, you can take away other animals, and the biosphere will thrive on without any problem because prokaryotes have all the metabolic abilities to go on. If you take away the prokaryotes, life on Earth will not go on for more than few thousand years or million years at the most. So clearly this is the most resistant, the oldest forms of life that we actually have to study. We want to understand how did life appear on Earth and how was it maintained during several millions or billions of years. Now, here we immediately face a problem. If we draw a timeline with the origin of the solar system and of the Earth at 4.6 10 to the 9 years ago and the present here to the right, one of the problems that we immediately recognize is that at the very beginning, the Earth was probably very hot. It was a very turbulent place with comets and meteorites falling all the time, with very unstable continents, very likely too hot to have water, liquid water on the surface. So if we have no water, it's very difficult to imagine how we could have life appearing. On the other hand, if we go back in time, and I have to say the Australians are extraordinarily privileged because some of the oldest evidence of microbial life comes from here and from the work of extremely distinguished scientists like my friend Malcolm Walter and so on, we can be quite sure that 3.5, 10 to the 9 years ago, there was already a thriving biosphere composed mostly of prokaryotes. We have very good evidence that life was a very, very dominant on the Earth since 3.5 years to today. The problem that we have is that clearly life must have evolved after these turbulent times, about 4.0 billion years ago, and older than 3.5 billion years ago, but we don't have any sedimentary rocks from this period. And if we don't have any sedimentary rocks, we are faced with a problem because we therefore cannot know the pH or how acidic the primitive ocean was. We have no idea of the composition of the primitive atmosphere. We do not know what was the temperature of the Earth. We have a big question mark, and let me warn you that this question mark will appear over and over during the rest of the lecture. We do not know how life appeared on Earth. Nevertheless, we have a very reasonable hypothesis that was proposed in 1924 in the Soviet Union and then developed in an extraordinary way a few years later in 1936 by Alexander Ivanovich Oparin, a friend, a professor, a colleague that I had the chance to interact with, who proposed the idea that first life had been heterotrophic. In other words, it was finding its sources of nourishment from organic molecules that had synthesized and had accumulated on the primitive Earth prior to the emergence of the first microbes. And Oparin's ideas were absolutely extraordinary because what he did basically was he showed an absolute disregard for the frontier separating different scientific disciplines. He was trained as a biochemist, but he decided to get up and look what was going on among the astronomers, among the geophysicists, among the planetologists, and came to the conclusion that the primitive Earth had an atmosphere that was highly reducing. Highly reducing meaning that it not only had no oxygen, no free oxygen, but also that it was rich in methane, hydrogen, ammonia, and a number of very reduced of compounds rich in hydrogen. Oparin proposed that the solar radiation, the heat from geological activity and so on, led to the synthesis of organic organic compounds, that these compounds were dissolved by rain into the ocean and formed the primitive soup, el minestrone primitivo, la sopa primitiva, vichyssoise, as you wish, and that in these oceans rich in organic molecules, the interaction between the different molecules led to droplets, the formation of droplets rich in organic molecules that began interacting among them. And from here, these droplets, which he termed quasarbates, led eventually to the first bacteria. They were heterotrophic because they were nourishing themselves from the compounds, organic compounds already available. They were anaerobic because they had appeared in an atmosphere, an environment that had no free oxygen. And they were prokaryotes because prokaryotes are the oldest forms of life. Now, if you look at this picture, you will see that there is no mention of nucleic acids for a very simple reason. When the book was published, James Watson was going to grammar school. The idea of double helix DNA as a depository of genetic material was not part of biology. Nevertheless, the theory is what we call in epistemology an open theory. It could accommodate a number of later discoveries without destroying the overall essence of the scheme that Oparin proposed. Now, do we have any evidence that indeed there was this synthesis of organic compounds? Yes, and the answer comes as a gift from the sky into Australia. In September 1969, a meteorite that we call now the Murchison meteorite, because it fell in Murchison, came into the earth, was quickly collected by a number of Australian farmers and scientists, and don't ask me why, but most of the meteorite ended up in the United States at NASA. Now, the very nice thing about NASA is that if you have a good project, you can actually receive parts of the meteorite and you can analyze it. And the most wonderful thing about this meteorite is that it turned out to be as old as the Earth itself. It's 4.6 billion years old. In other words, when this meteorite formed, the Earth itself was condensing. So here we have a sort of geochemical fossil of the conditions that were taking place on the Earth, on the solar system when the Earth was being formed. And the chemical analysis of this meteorite, which is nothing extraordinary, it's the same kind of analysis that you will do if you want to be tested for cholesterol or diabetes or whatever, and you go to the hospital and they take some blood or some urine and they do a number of analytical procedures. It's exactly the same procedures that we use But instead of urine or, well, we have urea here, but instead of urine or blood or saliva, what we actually analyze is part of the meteorite, and we discover hydrocarbons, amino acids, around 80 different amino acids, purines and pyrimidines, which are the components of nucleic acids. We discover urea, sugar derivatives, and we know that those sugar derivatives come from the transformation of deoxyribose and ribose, which are the sugars that we found in nucleic acids. We discover lipidic components, which are the what forms membranes. We discover alcohols, and not the ones that you would like to see, and carboxylic acids. So quite clearly, the meteorite is telling us that when the Earth was being formed, there were a number of chemical processes going on in the solar system. They were forming organic compounds, but not any kind of organic compounds, but especially the ones we associate with living entities, the same biochemical monomers that we see in living beings. So this clearly reinforces the idea that a similar process was in fact taking place on our own planet. Now, this is one way of confirming the studying the possibility of organic compounds in the primitive Earth. The other one is to simulate under laboratory conditions how they may have taken place. And the first to do so in a very successful way was my friend, my colleague, my professor, Stanley Miller, who when he was a graduate student in the University of Chicago working with Harold Urey, one of those extraordinary scientists, one of those extraordinary characters that Americans have all the right to feel extremely proud of. Stanley Miller decided, after he had been at the school for only a few weeks, that he wanted to do his PhD thesis trying to simulate the chemistry of the primitive Earth. And he actually designed a very simple experiment with these two flasks. In the upper flask, he had methane, ammonia, and hydrogen. And Here in the lower flask, he had boiling water. The water, as it boiled, came up here as vapor and mixed with the other gases. This was subject to the action of electric discharges for 1 week. And you can see how, after, in fact, a few hours, the chemical composition of the inside has been transformed. And as Stanley Miller was able to show, when he was only 22 years old, that indeed you can simulate the primitive Earth and synthesize without any major problem organic compounds such as amino acids. The paper was published in 1953, and in fact, if one looks at back in time, 1953 was what we can call an annus mirabilis by all accounts. Why? Because it was the year in which Watson and Crick, two young, bold, dashing scientists, they did not know sufficient chemistry, did not know enough physics, but were very clever and had the right intuition, came out with the idea of the DNA molecule as a double helix. It was the year in which Sanger and Thompson say that insulin is a protein in which the amino acids are not located randomly but follow a strict order, something that we diabetics are very happy with. And finally, is the year in which Stanley Miller demonstrated that under prebiotic conditions, you can synthesize organic compounds. The vintage of 1953 was not very good for wines in France. I discovered that. But it was extraordinary, extraordinary for biology. It was extraordinary for science, because this three discoveries made by young, bold people who had the willingness to try and go against the tide actually demonstrated that you can understand in a very logical way some of the components of living entities, some of the things that led to the origin and evolution of life. Now, the experiment by Stanley Miller actually opened up the laboratory study of prebiotic chemistry. And I think that nowadays it's fair to say that we can imagine the primitive Earth as a place in which, under, for instance, hydrothermal vents, you can have the synthesis of organic compounds. We can have electric discharges, and this can lead to the formation of organic molecules, as Miller demonstrated. We can have the same when we simulate the conditions near volcanoes. And, of course, we can picture without any problem the infall of meteorites or comets rich in organic molecules. If you look at the articles and the books published mostly by my American colleagues on the formation of the primitive soup, you will see that there's a tremendous discussion of which of these sources was more important in cooking the soup. Some people will argue that it was hydrothermal vents. Others will argue it was electric discharges. Some will say, no, what came from comets and meteorites is what led to the accumulation of amino acids, nucleobases, sugar, lipids, oligomers of these biochemical compounds. If you look at the discussion, it's very interesting because I think it's a very American discussion. And the question becomes, have too many cooks spoiled the soup? And I think the answer is no. If you come from cultures that have developed very sophisticated cuisine, like the Mediterranean people, like India, like China, like Mexico, or like Australians, you quickly realize that if it works, it's edible. You never despise any single source of organics. In Australia, I should say, if it jumps, it's edible. You never, never despise any single source of organic material. So some of us have the impression that one shouldn't think of a single source of organic compounds for the primitive Earth, but rather have a very eclectic view in which different processes led to the accumulation of different amounts of organic compounds. The more organic molecules you have, much the better. And of course, we have not solved the issue of the origins of life, but if I had to do a balance, if I had to analyze the contribution done by my friends working in prebiotic chemistry, I think it's fair to say that although we do not know how life appeared on Earth, all the evidence that we have suggests that prior to the origins of life, the Earth was already endowed with a very wide array of organic compounds of biochemical significance, that there were many organic and inorganic catalysts, that there were purines and pyrimidines, which means there's the potential for nucleic acid replication, and finally, that there were also membrane-forming compounds. Once again, let me underline, we do not know how life appeared on Earth. But what I am listing here is in fact proper, are in fact properties that we normally associate with living entities. Organic composition, catalyst, replication, and isolation and individuality by membranes. So I think that in spite of the many uncertainties that we have regarding the origins of life, what we know of organic chemistry, of prebiotic simulations of the primitive Earth, strongly suggests that we are working on the right path. Now, what happens if we try to put all these things together? Well, Jack Szostak from Harvard University did precisely that, and in an extraordinary set of papers that the most significant one, I think, was the one published last year in Nature, he demonstrated that you can come out with droplets made of lipids. You can put inside the droplets DNA, which happens to be very stable, and it's a very good reason for choosing it. And then outside you can put the nucleotides, and the nucleotides will go across the membrane, very much to the surprise of everyone. Theory did not predict that. They can actually polymerize reading the template, reading the single-stranded DNA you have on the inside. And as the droplet grows more and more and more because of the accumulation of organic compounds, it will break up into different droplets. It's not a living system at all. But here we have the possibility of something that looks like replication of nucleic acids inside a membrane, and it's strongly reminiscent of what happened in cells. So this probably implies that we are actually along the right way, working on the right direction. Now, what we would really like to know is how did, in this primitive soup, develop what Francis Crick once called the central dogma of molecular biology. We know that nowadays DNA can replicate, stores genetic information, and replicates thanks to proteins. We know that proteins do not replicate but are endowed with catalytic activity. And for many, many years, this became the chicken and egg problem in origins of life. What came first? Proteins that can catalyze or DNA that can replicate? And I have to say that the problem, the discussion went beyond laboratories, went beyond libraries and meetings and so on, and became a very political and ideological discussion. It's very interesting to read the papers that were published in the 60s and 70s and to see that some of my more leftist colleagues were inclined to favor the idea of proteins emerging first, and they will say, because Engels says in Dialectics of Nature that a protein precedes is a central basis of life. And some of my most conservative colleagues will say, no, DNA came first, because it's like the general directing the army of molecules inside the cells. It's like the administrator of a big company. And it's fascinating to see how our intellectual, social, political prejudices can bias our understanding of biological processes. Well, in one of the most amazing statements I have seen of how political the discussion came about, in 1961, Hermann Müller, a very distinguished, extraordinary good American geneticist, claimed that operins' refusal of acknowledging that DNA had appeared before proteins was part of a Soviet conspiracy to run against the development of genetics in a worldwide level. The discussion became very intense. It became truly illogical in many ways, but the question remains, what came first, DNA or proteins? Well, the answer probably is that what came first is RNA. RNA for many, many years had been the ugly duckling of molecular biology. It had been just the go-between, il postino, as they will say in Italiano, el intermediario in Spanish. But RNA is actually a very peculiar nucleic acid. What does it mean to be RNA? Well, all of you remember that famous remark, the scene of the balcony of Romeo and Juliet, where are you, Capuleto and Mama Montesco, or other way. I always get mixed up with the families in Verona. But what's in a name for the case of RNA? RNA is a nucleic acid with bases attached to a ribosphosphate backbone. And this backbone has ribose, which is a sugar. O's is for sugars. And rib are the initial for the Rockefeller Institute of Biochemistry. Which means that at the intimacy of our cells, we carry the name of one of the hardest representatives of hardcore capitalism, Rockefeller. Regardless of that, what is extraordinary is the flexibility and the richness of a special conformation that you can have of RNA. And this led in the late 60s to proposals by three different extraordinary scientists, by Carl Woese in 1967, by Leslie Orgel in 1968, and Francis Crick in 1968, to the idea that there had been a very early stage in life during which RNA had been the central molecule in biological processes. This was done in a time in which there was no evidence at all of the catalytic activity of RNA. But this gentleman had an extraordinary intuition of the many roles of RNA and proposed that RNA appear before proteins and DNA. And let me underline the word intuition, because normally we associate men with rationality and women with intuition. Intuition is sort of despises a second way of the secondary way of thinking. I still have to meet a scientist, a good scientist, a good scholar, who lacks good intuition. Intuition was something that was abundant in the proposal made by these three gentlemen, and they were the first to propose the idea of an RNA world, a world in which catalytic activity was performed by RNA, and RNA was, in fact, the molecule that was also storing genetic information. And 20 years later on, their intuition was demonstrated to be true. We know now that RNA molecules can store genetic information, like DNA, like we see in the polio virus, in the influenza virus, in the HIV virus, and we know also that RNA can perform can catalyze chemical reactions like proteins. And this led to the idea that once there was an RNA world in which a replicative RNA was encoding for a catalytic RNA that was helping to replicate catalytic RNA. And there was a wonderful paper published in February this year in Science by Jerry Joyce from the Scripps Research Institute demonstrating that indeed you can have an RNA that self-replicates and goes and changes and evolves without any major problem. We have very good proof of the idea that there was once in the evolution of life an RNA world. So I think it's fair to say that we know how to cook a primitive soup. We really don't have any problem understanding the accumulation of organic compounds of the primitive earth. We do not know, and let me emphasize this, we do not know how to get from the primitive soup into the RNA world. Perhaps they were intermediates. Perhaps there were different kinds of genetic polymers that we know nothing about. But the interaction of RNA with amino acids clearly shows that protein biosynthesis evolved in an RNA world. We know that DNA was selected for because it stabilizes in a wonderful way genetic information. And once you have DNA, RNA, and proteins, you can have this extraordinary diversification of life. We can reconstruct most of the major steps that led to life and diversification of life on Earth. But furthermore, we can put that in a wider context. We actually recognize that life appeared very quickly on Earth, and the emergence and evolution of life eventually led to cyanobacteria. Cyanobacteria liberate oxygen as a waste product. This led to a major change in the chemical characteristics, in the physical characteristics of our planet. As oxygen began to accumulate, this led to the emergence of eukaryotes, cells that are the outcome of processes of endosymbiosis and that eventually led to animal, plants, fungi, and a wide number of proteins. And the extraordinary diversity that we see of life today is, in fact, the result of the co-evolution between the planet and the biosphere. The biosphere has not been the passive receptor of selection pressures put by the environment, but the biosphere has also actively changed the earth, the waters, the land, the soil of the planet that we live on. And all this, of course, comes from the inheritance of Charles Darwin. We clearly have to cherish the wonderful idea behind, the wonderful thoughts, the wonderful framework provided by the idea of natural selection and evolutionary theory. And the British actually celebrate Darwin in many different ways. For instance, they have a £10 bill with Charles Darwin's picture. And we are slightly less materialistic, but nevertheless, we are happy to cherish the inheritance of Charles Darwin, and we even have a tequila that's called Evolution. Thank you very much. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Antonio. That's an absolutely wonderful story. I'm told we have time for 2 minutes? No. Look, I'm sorry. We have to stop at this point because we're over. No, I'm sorry. We have to stop because we're here at this time. But if I could just speak on behalf of everyone to say I think that is the most wonderful outline of the excitement of the discovery, a masterly overview of the last 150 years of how we have come to understand this better. And I hope that you'll all leave with a much clearer idea of the history of life and some of the excitement of discovery that's gone on the route to bring us here. Thank you very much, Antonio.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.